Hello and welcome to the podcast of the Lotus Eaters for the 19th of April 2021. I'm joined by Carl. And today we're going to be talking about the George Floyd trial being wrapped up. Tomorrow we have, today, because American time, we'll have the closing arguments, but otherwise it's done. So we're going to be going through what was said on the defense's side of the argument. They finally got to present their side. We're going to be talking about the Black Grift Matters folks trying to defend the fact that trained Marxists deserve four houses that are worth millions. And also whether or not we should celebrate genetic dead ends. That's how I'm phrasing it.
Do we celebrate the empty egg carton? Yes or no?
The symbol of the new age, the empty egg carton.
One 53-year-old divorcee says yes.
Oh, boy. Anyway, let's get right into it in a minute. So I just wanted to mention here first the Section 127 petition, which we've been pushing on this podcast, and I'm hoping people share around and whatnot. Thank you all for signing. We're at 9,400 signatures now, so just 600 signatures off getting the 10K milestone, which gets us a response from the government in which they say their opinions on Section 127, and it'll be interesting to read if nothing else. So please sign it, send it to groups, send it to content creators to share out with their audiences. I'd really like to see this get to 10,000 at least, and then up to 100,000 if we can.
Yeah.
So apart from that, we also have the podcast you did with Josh.
Yeah,
about Hunter Biden.
Yeah, we've got loads of premium content, of course, which is available to members of the website, which is how we're funded and how we are allowed to continue on. So thank you, everyone who has become a member. And if you're interested in more from us, you can become a member. Josh and I did Josh prepared a massive amount of information about the life and times of Hunter Biden. And it's very interesting to have it all laid out in such a methodical way. And so we go through it in a premium podcast that'll be up later. Really worth your time to see just how deeply the corruption in Joe Biden's family goes. With it being juxtaposed with the with the tragedy as well, which is interesting. It's against this kind of background of really, really tragic events that have happened. But I don't think that justifies taking millions from the Chinese and the Russians and the Ukrainians. I don't know why that's supposed to be like a defense.
Yeah,
but I mean, look at what happened. So yeah, okay, but you're selling out your country to your rivals.
It is doubly disgusting that the media response at the time when this first came out was, this is a right-wing smear job, it can't be true.
Or the
and
social
now the election's
media.
Over.
Move or on. The social media response of, we're not going to let you share this on Twitter.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Unbelievable. Anyway, let's get right into it. So the third thing I wanted to go through first was the George Floyd, Derek Chauvin trial, in which they're trying Chauvin for manslaughter and unintentional third-degree homicide in the state. So I just wanted to wrap up where we left off. It's going to be a bit abridged because, well, you've mostly heard most of the arguments, so we're just going to be skipping over this. Also, for anyone who's joining, we don't care about who wins this, you know, whether he's acquitted or not. We just find it interesting that the media has one perception of this, which is entirely that Chauvin is the devil who tried to kill him, and there's no arguments from the defense whatsoever, and that's just not the case. There are arguments from the defense. Maybe you find them convincing, maybe you don't, but let's get into it. So just wanted to get, I'm also going to just be a bit memey with this because I'm sort of bored. I've covered a lot of this. We've gone off for days. So the first thing here, so day 12 we've got here, and if we can get the first image up, so the job of the defense, drive this home. So they're pretty set. They're just on the defense side now. They're witnesses. So all they have to do is just tuck it into the parking space. So the prosecution had no more witnesses to show. So the first thing they did is they asked a cop who had previously interacted with Floyd about his experiences of pulling Floyd over before. They showed a video of him interacting. And the first thing Floyd did in this video was grab some pills and throw them in his mouth. Presumably the same pills that are alleged to have killed him or contributed to his death in this case. And they had to tell him to spit them out, and they got him out of his mouth and then arrested him. So just to point out that Floyd does this on the often whenever he's pulled over by the cops, which is not good evidence for the prosecution. So they also interviewed a lady named Shawanda Hill, who was in the car with Floyd and Maurice Hall, who was the drug dealer. And she tried to give evidence that was complimentary to Floyd, but it didn't work out very well. She was very weird, like very erratic. Like, I don't know if she was high or not, but it wasn't normal at all. She admits that Floyd, ends up admitting that Floyd
Was this his girlfriend?
No. This is just a friend.
This is
so
just
his ex-girlfriend. Right. Sorry, friend. She was in the car. She admitted that he was sleepy in the car. He fell asleep at some point. They had to shake him to wake him up, which is big bad news for the prosecution because they were trying to argue that it couldn't have been fentanyl that interfered with him because he would be sleepy and drowsy. And he was awake. And it was like, well, if he was sleeping in the car and then he got out, and then he's got meth in it as well. That would explain why he's not sleepy the whole time. But that's not good for them. So when the store clerk came out, he was sleepy. She also then started arguing with the prosecution when they tried to question her. they were like, oh, please give us your version of events that obviously looks good to George Floyd. And she's asked to explain something. And then she goes off on like a massive rant that has nothing to do with it. And then the prosecution is like trying to, oh, Jesus, what is she doing? So he tries to interfere. She's like, oh, come on, you told me to explain it. It's like, yeah, okay. you're not looking very credible. Anyway, then they spoke to a guy called Officer Chang. He's a Parks police officer. He came round to help out Chauvin and his people. So he spent most of his time babysitting Maurice Hall, the drug dealer, and the ex-girlfriend, Shawanda Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting from that is that they, Maurice Hall, the drug dealer, and Shawanda Hill, the ex-girlfriend, were complaining at Floyd for resisting. You could hear them being like, why is he resisting? You're going to go to jail now, that kind of thing, which didn't look great.
Yeah.
Also, the police officer says he had to keep looking over because he was scared for fellow officers' safety because of the crowd that was forming. So again, painting the crowd out to be threatening. And then there was the witness, which we've mentioned before, who's the lady who was meant to be a witness for the prosecution, but ended up helping the defense so much that he called her back. So there's a lady here. I can't remember her name, but she's called back. And all that she really did was just confirm that Floyd did have all the symptoms of excited delirium, the fancy term for saying he was high AF.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. And then they called the use of force expert, which the guy I'm reading is a for the notes, because I don't understand all American legal procedures and all the rest of it.
Sure.
His notes made it out that he's an expert in use of force, and he was judging this guy who's an expert witness in use of force. So I don't know how much it's just, oh, I know better.
Sure. There's a good deal of opinion.
Yeah, I would have had a better response to that kind of thing. Because he goes off on him and saying he did a very bad job, or at least a not great job. And I'm assuming that's true by the looks of it, but because there were some F-ups. But he did do a good job, he mentions, at pointing out that Chauvin and his officers are not expected to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You're not expected to react to an instance immediately in a change of circumstance because you're not a robot, you're a human being. And the jury have to judge him on that basis. And also the fact that you have to take the totality of what's going on into account. You can't just take one expert into account. So, for example, the prosecution would ask him things like, oh, what about when George Floyd's on the ground? He's no longer a threat in this particular instance, and therefore the use of force is justified.
Mm.
And he had to say yes to that. Well, okay, in that specific point, but if you take the totality into effect, the fact he's resisting, the fact he was clearly high on drugs, so on and so forth.
It's a hostile crowd.
Yeah, it becomes more reasonable. There was one major F-up I saw, though, which was that it was just embarrassing. The Nelson, the defense, asked the use of force expert, was putting him on the ground a use of force? And he said no, which is obviously not the case. That doesn't make any sense. So when the prosecution asked him, was it? He had to admit, oh yeah, I misspoke, but it made him look stupid. And so there's things like that. So the next day, day 13, in which they had another guy come on, the first bit of housekeeping is Maurice Hall turned up and pled the fifth, because I mean, you would, wouldn't you? So then they had Dr. Fowler here, if we can get his image. So I've dubbed him Dr. Rhodesia as well because of his accent. his the meme version of him, looking like Dracula. So he came out and gave his medical opinion on that it was...
We need some standards.
We need some standards. Yes, that was... So to quote him, George Floyd had sudden cardiac arrhythmia due to... long medical word I can't read, and hypersensitive heart disease during his restraint by the police. So he went on to argue that his heart condition, his bad heart, one of his arteries being blocked 75% or whatever it was, and also the fact that he had drugs in his system, fentanyl to 3 times the lethal dose, small amount of meth in there. These factors contributed to such a degree that he thinks he got to the low oxygen. He agrees with the prosecution on that, but the low oxygen was caused by other things than just Chauvin. And therefore, it's not entirely Chauvin's fault, and therefore you can't really charge him with manslaughter or homicide. That's his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
He also randomly said that carbon monoxide might have contributed because he was down by the car near the exhaust. I was like, huh, okay. Didn't see that coming.
No.
And this really riled the prosecution. Like, they got really mad about this and started being argumentative with him. There were some funny points where they were trying to say that, trying to discredit him, and they were saying, well, are you familiar with this type of car? And he's like, yes, it's this type of car. Huh, okay. Are you familiar with how many exhausts it has? Yes, 4 exhausts, 2 on each side. Okay, moving on. didn't want to talk about that. So
happens to also be a car expert.
Yeah, I don't know why. He's just really prepared for this. But so then he finished his testimony and then turned into a bat and flew back to Transylvania or whatever. And whilst he was on the plane on the way home, and the next day, day 14, the prosecution got a bit mad. So Chauvin pled the fifth, because, I mean, you would, wouldn't you? why would you want to be cross-examined by the prosecution? So
maybe say that, look, I wasn't trying to kill the guy.
But that's the thing. Your defense has already done that for
you.
And then when you get on the stand, the prosecution's going to ask you questions and try and trap you. So, I mean, why would you? So the if we can get Chauvin pleading the fifth up, artist interpretation of what went on in the courtroom, counseling him. So if we can get the next image, they brought new evidence. So the new evidence they brought was about carbon monoxide. So they were really annoyed that the guy previously had said that there was carbon monoxide in his blood.
Yeah.
So whilst he's on a plane home, they were like, haha, Dr. Tobin, that really good doctor from our side, we'd like him to come back and testify about carbon monoxide levels. And the judge got really annoyed that they brought this up this late in the trial. So we can get the next image, just an artist rendition of how annoyed he was, and decided that he would listen to this, and there is an argument for them. So my understanding is that the prosecution can bring up something this late, this consequential, if there are new scientific questions which they weren't briefed on before. So something brand new comes up.
Yep.
Fair enough. But it turned out that they had been provided with questions about carbon monoxide weeks in advance, so they had no leg to stand on because they're the ones in control of the blood. They're the state. They're the ones who are meant to find out the carbon monoxide levels. And they didn't until this far in the case, so that it couldn't be admitted. And so the judge got really annoyed, if we can get the next image, and threatened them with a mistrial if they dare mention the data about carbon monoxide. So he would allow Dr. Tobin to come back on to talk about the level of oxygen, but not the level of carbon monoxide, because otherwise he would call a mistrial and then the whole thing would be out.
Right.
So the Dr. Tobin did come back on. He said there was 98% oxygen, so inferring that 2% carbon monoxide, and that was that.
But hang on, if the argument is he doesn't have enough oxygen in his bloodstream...
I don't understand the science of it.
He's got 98% oxygen in his bloodstream, 92% carbon monoxide?
Yeah, that didn't look great for that argument, the fact that he's died of not having enough oxygen in his bloodstream.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, oh no, it was 98% oxygenated, don't worry about it.
Seems largely like a waste of time, to be honest.
Right.
I don't think it was anything new.
No, I don't think it's conclusive.
It was just really funny, this little work, this little dance. And then they're going for their closing arguments tomorrow, as I mentioned. So this will be, I assume, Nelson's dress for the evening, in which he'll be giving his closing arguments, and then the prosecution will be giving theirs. So you might think, oh, I'm not very taking this seriously, am I, with all these memes? No, I'm not, because no one else is. So why should we? There's the facts. You've heard the facts a million times. All the other episodes we've done have given you the details of it. But people aren't really interested in that, at least the people on the ground who have an investment in this. So you can see this is Jack Posobiec, who's my interpretation of what the right-wing response is to this, which is, I don't really care. This isn't really a bipartisan issue for the right. Not that interested. Partisan issue. Like, we're not that interested in it. It's just funny. So, like, he's just posting memes of Nelson as well, because, I mean, why not? It has got a good laugh. But then there's the reaction from the left in the United States, which does see this as a highly, highly partisan issue. So here's Maxine Waters, who went down to the protest outside and decided to call for violence, because that's what a responsible congresswoman
does. Not the first time.
Let's play the video.
I would like to see the bill in Congress pass on police reform, but I know that the right wing, the racists, are opposed to it, and I don't know what's going to happen to it. But I know this, we've got to stay in the street, and we've got to demand justice.
As a black man, despite all of the efforts, I feel like nothing changes. And George Floyd is waking so many people up, yet nothing has happened, despite the rhetoric. Like, what needs to happen that's different this year than all the years before?
We're looking for a guilty verdict. We're looking for a guilty verdict. And we're looking to see if all of the talk that took place and has been taking place after they saw what happened to George Floyd, if nothing does not happen, then we know that we've got to not only stay in the street, but we've got to fight for justice. But I am very hopeful, and I hope that we're going to get a verdict that is say guilty, guilty, guilty. And if we don't, we cannot go away.
And not just manslaughter, right? I mean...
Oh, no, not manslaughter. No. This is guilty. Murder. I don't know whether it's in the first degree, but as far as I'm concerned, it's first degree.
Ms. Congresswoman, murder. What happens if we do not get what you just told? What should the people do? What should protesters on the street do?
I didn't hear you.
What happens?
What should protesters do?
Well, we got to stay on the street, and we've got to get more active. We've got to get more confrontational. We've got to make sure that they know that we mean business.
So I know for a lot of people, it's probably hard to hear that because of her mask and all the rest
sure.
of it. So some of the quotes out of that, we've got to stay on the street and demand justice.
We've got to get more confrontational.
We're looking for a guilty verdict. If we don't get that, we can't go away. And when asked about what charges, the guy says, what about manslaughter? She says, we're not looking for just a manslaughter charge. That wouldn't be enough. She wants him charged with homicide. And he is facing manslaughter and third degree unintentional homicide. And she says, I don't know if the homicide is in the first degree, meaning intentional homicide, but that's what we need. It's like, but he's not, he can't be found guilty of something he's not being charged with.
But need for what?
That's what they need. They need him to go to jail for first degree homicide. Otherwise, they're going to stay in the streets, be more confrontational, more active, and demand justice. And they need to know that we mean business. I mean, it's not very veiled of a threat. It's pretty open a threat.
Pretty transparent veil, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't feel like my dignity is being fully covered here, Maxine.
And this isn't Maxine Waters' first time. Many people will know. No. She got in trouble for this previously, in which she was talking about, what was it, Republican senators?
Yeah, if you see them out in the streets going, form a mob and get up in their faces, something like that.
Yeah, demand justice. Yep. And it was just like, no, this isn't on. That's not how you run a democratic country. Mm. And she should be...
Well, it's intimidation. Open intimidation along partisan lines for reasons that lie outside of the democratic framework.
So in response, of course, the people taking her words to hand, I presume, I mean, I'm not being entirely serious about that, but this is the atmosphere she's creating, which is that people go out and do stuff like this. So Minnesota National Guard reporting that someone drove up to them and opened fired on them. Someone opened fire on the National Guard for being in Minneapolis. That was it.
4:19 a.m.
Just a drive-by shooting on the National Guard.
As you do.
Perfectly normal things, I'm sure. So the response from this I saw from some people, particularly Vox.com journalists, were to say that this didn't happen.
Oh.
It's worth noting that the only evidence of the alleged drive-by shooting offered in this story is a statement from the National Guard. Yeah.
I'm sure they're lying, Aaron.
I sure they am lying, which is why the pictures of the bullet holes in the Humvees are not real. We can get the
probably
next
did them
up.
Themselves. Just turn the guns and poof.
Yeah, so you can get the next one up. So that someone just released the images of the Humvee that had been shot and has bullet holes in there. I mean, if this isn't evidence, I don't know what you want, but I guess Vox.com has different standards.
What's your evidence? Well, these bullet holes here.
Like, do they need to die? Is that it? Well, I'm asking Vox. I suppose it is. So there's also some other perfectly reasonable responses, which the... one of the witnesses for the defense has had his former home attacked. So this was the use of force expert who was giving his perception, the one that... plans. You can just go back to the tweet, because the tweet has the image. So the home of the his former home, so not even his current home, some perfectly reasonable people from the left decided to turn up and throw pig's blood all over the house. Because that's normal. Someone's engaging in the judicial progress... and you decide to throw pig blood all over the house.
Yeah, I mean...
because you want justice, don't you?
You can't really describe this as anything other than intimidation, can you?
Yeah, it's just witness intimidation. Yeah. They've also, previously, people have been trying to dox the jurors because they want justice.
Yep, the New York Times posted as much information as they could find on the jurors.
Yeah, I suppose...
because they are responsible people running a responsible newspaper.
Like, when you want a free and fair system in which jurors are able to come to a conclusion based on the evidence and not threats, you dox them. That's what you do. That's perfectly reasonable. And this is the situation in Minneapolis. I imagine no matter what happens, it will turn into a burning
ground. Oh, absolutely.
Just like last year.
Black Lives Matter have already threatened this, so we know that that's going to happen.
That's why the National Guard are there. That's why they're being shot at.
Yeah, that's why the courthouse is literally an armed compound with razor wire and armed guards.
Like, they've already made the decision. It doesn't matter what the evidence is. I mean, the people who have watched this show and watched other readings on it, I mean... good that you've been reading up on this stuff and finding out what the truth is, but they don't care, do they? They're never going to care. And so one of the things that is a white pill, let's say, out of this, is that the GOP is pushing to get Maxine Waters presumably impeached or sanctioned on the basis that she's inciting violence, which she is.
Yeah.
Like, I know that the Democrat rebuttal will be like, oh, but what about Trump? And I'm like, okay. But he literally said in his speech, patriotically and peacefully make your voice heard. What is Maxine saying? We need to stand out in the streets. We need to make sure that they know we know.
We need to be more confrontational.
Yep. They need to know that we mean business. And then someone gets shot. I mean, the National Guard gets shot. And this isn't her first time either. This isn't a slip of the tongue. She knows what she's doing. So good for the Democrats. Sorry, good for the Republicans to hold them account to this. And I hope she does get sanctioned or impeached. But knowing the Democrats, they'll probably stand by her.
I mean, they undoubtedly will stand by her. But what she's asking for is just awful, and I don't know why it's not being treated as if it is awful.
It's mob justice.
It's mob justice. It's unironically a lynching.
Vote Democrat.
Yeah.
I mean, what
we
statement?
Haven't changed.
Boy.
It's, well, like, who do you think was doing all the lynchings back in the day? Yeah. Wasn't yeah. Republicans, incidentally.
Yeah,
I didn't think I'd ever be such a strident defender of the record of the Republicans, but the Democrats are just awful. Absolutely awful. I can't imagine being black and voting for the Democrats. It's like, we've changed. Yeah, why would I trust you?
Not even that. I mean, just being anyone and voting for the Democrats at this point.
Well, sure.
Like if you believe in just, you know, property rights, the individual rights at all,
no,
how can you vote Democrat
fine.
On this basis?
Yeah. There are loads of leftist white communists, right? But if you're like, yeah, okay, so, you know, 50 years ago, we had Jim Crow, Democrats. And then before that, we had whatever, Democrats.
We had the Klan.
The Klan, Democrats. Yeah. Then we had slavery, Democrats. It's like, why would you vote Democrat? So you're like, oh, yeah, but like this is the white supremacist. Yeah, well, that was the white supremacist. Oh, they've changed now. Are you taking their word for it? Are you?
Don't worry, we've changed. We now define black people in more esoteric terms.
It's like, sorry, you're just taking their word for it. It's so weird.
Oh, man. Like, anyway, so yeah, that's a summation of what's happened with the George Floyd trial. God, it's going to be a mess, isn't it?
But unironically, Lincoln was a Republican. Like, he founded the Republican Party to end slavery. Like, I can't imagine why black people would not be like, look, we are diehard Republicans. Like, this is baked into what it is to be black in America, is to be a Republican. Because, I mean, I don't want to be on the side of the slave owners and the Klan.
Yeah.
It just boggles my mind.
It's weird.
Boggles my mind.
But anyway, tell me about how black grifts matter.
Yeah, well, black grifts do matter. You may remember Patrice Cullors. She's one of the co-founders of the organization of Black Lives Matter. And she has described herself as a trained Marxist. She's the protege of Eric Mann, a former agitator of the Weather Underground Domestic Terror Organization. And she apparently is a Marxist-Leninist, according to her own viewpoint. She says, we do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia, in particular, are trained organizers. Now, this is in the Alinsky use of the term organizer. This isn't someone who organizes birthday parties. These are people who organize revolutions. Read Rules for Radicals if you don't know anything about this. It's not very long, and it's really, really interesting. And you really should read it. We're trained Marxists. We're super versed on sort of ideological theories. And I think what we really try to do is build a movement that could be utilized by many, many black folk. And in that movement, she managed to raise $90 million last year. That's pretty good. And this is specifically for the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. So there are lots and lots and lots of different organizations that operate under the general term Black Lives Matter. It's been estimated that they've raised $1 billion. Possibly more, but like altogether, who can know? You know, there's no tally. But the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation raised $90 million last year. And Patrice Cullors told the Associated Press that they need to reinvest in black communities. One of our biggest goals this year was taking the dollars we were able to raise in 2020 and building out the institution we've been trying to build for the last 7.5 years. Presumably is giving black people money, building things for black people. It's hard to know. Before we go on, though, it's worth noting that Black Lives Matter have publicly been opposed to the Western prescribed nuclear family. This was on their website. They got a huge amount of criticism for it because it sounds terrible. This is the quote. We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and villages that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. Mission accomplished, I guess, if you look at the rate of broken families in the black community. It seems they've successfully disrupted the Western prescribed nuclear family structure, and I guess they're comfortable with literally 75% of black children being born to single parents.
With wonderful results.
Amazing results.
Yeah.
It's incredible. They've the best results, which is why all of the highest earning demographics of society have strong family structures, incidentally. And it turns out that in America, black people are pretty much at the bottom, and it's because of their family structure. But incidentally, this isn't
something
a prophecy.
Something Black Lives Matter celebrate.
It kind of. It's the core of the activist base that they're relying on here. But what's interesting, though, is I read, I can't remember which Thomas Sowell book it was, But in the book, he was pointing out that, look, if you have married, if you compare married, like for like, say married white families with married black families, the difference is actually only about 10 grand a year in earnings, something like 77,000 to 68,000 or something like that. And so between white and black. So it's actually not that there's a massive differential if they follow a similar life path. But the problem is they don't follow the same life path and they don't get married. They have kids out of wedlock and they don't get educated. And therefore, the black community is in a downward spiral, whereas the other communities aren't in this downward spiral. But anyway, this is why Black Lives Matter got all of this backlash, because it's so patently obvious that depriving children of a healthy home life is an evil thing to do. And it's not good for them. But it is good for Black Lives Matter. And at the end of all of this, Patrice ended up with 4 homes, which is nice. I don't have 4 homes. How many homes do you have?
None.
Wow, you want to start advocating for Black Lives Matter, Callum?
Yeah, maybe I do.
Maybe you do, because I mean, like, this was on the heels of her buying that $1.4 million compound.
And that's 4 homes since 2016.
Since 2016. Now, I mean, like, nothing I've ever owned could be described as a compound. It's just, especially not for $1.5 million. In a very remote and privileged Los Angeles neighborhood. She obviously owns a bunch of 4 other homes. Three other homes. Bernie Sanders looking like the second most successful Marxist grifter in America with only 3 homes. But yeah, this is...
Only three.
Only three. What a loser. He's not Marxisting hard enough. He really needs to get on that. But yeah, so I mean, and all of these homes are amazing. The cheapest one is $400,000. The other ones are $590,000 and then about $720,000. And it's like, wow, that's incredible. Like, I just don't own anything that expensive.
And then one $1.4 million.
Yeah. And so the backlash from this was cynical, but predictable and valid, because the question is, hang on, how do you, a trained Marxist who's an activist, professional activist for a massive organization that's seeking to improve black lives, how are you ending up with this amount of wealth? Sure. And she came out and said, look, it's fine. It's fine.
I'm a libertarian now.
Yeah, exactly. Based capitalist Marxists have arisen out of the black community to show everyone that Marxism can actually be incredibly profitable. You can make a lot of money being a Marxist. Now, we already knew this from BreadTube, but it's nice to see that this is a universal rule. It's not just online internet grifters who can make millions being Marxists. It's people in real life as well. Let's watch the clip.
Also a critique, though, from the left that would say, if you are a trained Marxist, if we're talking about a certain kind of radical politic, that extravagant homes of any sort or multiple properties of any sort is itself contradictory to the ideology that you hold. And so it's not about having money per se, but that it's about or about property per se, but it's about there being a potential contradiction between your expressed politics and your lived practice.
Sure. And I think that is a critique that is wanting. And I say that because the way that I live my life is in direct support to Black people, including my Black family members, first and foremost. And for so many Black folks who are able to invest in themselves and their community, they choose to invest in their family. And that's what I've chosen to do. I have a child, I have a brother that has severe mental illness that I take care of. I support my mother, and I support many other family members of mine. And so I see my money as not my own. I see it as my family's money as well.
It just happens to be in her bank account.
Support Black Lives Matter by funding my Black family.
Yeah.
Literally. That's a defense?
I mean, it does seem a tad self-serving. But no, what I love about this is not only in...
it's like the king of Benin or something being like...
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We are going to disrupt the Western prescribed family structure for you, but not for me. I'm going to keep that because I care about my family and they're important to me. Also, we need money for black people. Who? Me, not you. I need a fourth house. I'm sorry.
Like, man, I need money for white people. Specifically me. Just me.
but that's the point. You know, if she's like, well, I'm a black woman, give me money...
It's like a 2-year-old reasoning it.
Yes. Well, you have improved black lives. Hmm. Mine.
I black. My life improved. All good.
So, you know, that's it's just really interesting how this just serves to secure her in her place of owning lots of houses, as every communist should. And this was a great defense of this that I found on The Independent. I love this so much, right? So why exactly do you think that Black Lives Matter founder Patrice Cullors shouldn't live in a multi-million dollar house? What's the answer, Callum?
Because she's a trained mom.
No, because you're a racist. That's why. Obviously, look at who's written this. Of course it's because you're a racist.
Yeah.
When I first heard about the controversy surrounding Cullors' wealth, it gave me pause. Then I realized that I'd been conditioned to think about a certain way about the black struggle and black success.
I was conditioned to think of it in a Marxist way, not in just capitalist, ruthless capitalism, which you just take all the money, say you're going to spend it on something, and just keep it for yourself.
True communism is being the most ruthless capitalist you can be.
Yeah.
Based.
This is literally, you remember the Australian meme where the leader of Black Lives Matter Australia was just some Australian S poster who just took all the money and was like, like, but she's the head of the foundation.
Yeah. And she's taking all the money and he's like,
oh man.
What are you going to do? Seize the means of production?
Don't worry, I patented them all.
But anyway, so she says, it's a distraction that's a bitter pill to swallow, not because Cullors has declared her support for Marxism, but because of the timing. We're not asking ourselves why Duante Wright was shot and killed this week. We're asking why a woman who founded a racial justice movement has a multi-million dollar home. Well, I mean, that is a valid question, though, isn't it? Like, why is she taking donations from the public to help black people and buying herself lots of new houses?
Those are such obvious whataboutery.
Yes.
Yeah, what about this going on? Yeah, yeah, but you've still got four homes?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't change the fact.
The reaction to Cullors' ability to buy a nice house speaks volumes about what we think black people should fight for and what black people should have access to. What an absolute grift! What an absolute grift! My racism!
Oh, man.
I mean, it's not like there haven't been, like, massively wealthy black people in Hollywood and, you know, the entertainment industry and whatever, in other businesses.
But they weren't Marxist enough.
Exactly. They weren't Marxists. You know, Kanye West just happens to be a billionaire living up and wherever he lives with his massive homes. And no one's like, Kanye West doesn't deserve those homes because he's black.
I can see Bernie Sanders now being like, Marxists make up 20% of the population. They should be 20% of the millionaires. Oh, man.
But I love this bit, right? I'll be honest. Discovering the Cullors could afford to buy a nice house in an affluent part of Los Angeles gave me pause too. As an LA resident, I'm acutely aware of the city she and I both live in is struggling with homeless rates that have increased exponentially since the pandemic began. She doesn't say it, but I don't doubt that disproportionately affects people of color. Don't know why she left that out all of a sudden, but anyway, right? The increasing number of homeless encampments on the drive between my home and my kids' school is, quite frankly, heartbreaking.
Well.
But after that pause, I immediately called myself out, right? So if you have a thought that you realize is unorthodox, you have to call yourself out, right?
I'm going to cancel myself, comrade.
Well, you know,
I'm embarrassing the party.
I called myself out because I realized that the pause itself was connected to how I've been conditioned to view the black struggle. When we talk about equity, we often look at the lowest common denominator, access to decent, not good schools, functional, but not amazing housing, the ability to live our lives without prejudice and not necessarily live our lives to the fullest. You don't have to call yourself out for being concerned about Patrice's grift, lady. The truth is that we've been conditioned to believe that advocates for equality and equity should or do have limited funds. But in reality, really, the whole attitude is upside down. After all, isn't equity about everyone having access to the same opportunities, each according to their need? But
everyone deserves a mansion.
Everyone needs this $1.5 million mansion.
But everyone needs four homes as well. Like, the ghoul to bring up homelessness.
Each according to their need,
like,
Callum.
We're talking about a woman with four homes and you're like, yeah, homelessness exists. Yeah, well, maybe three of those homes she's not staying in right
now.
Got
a big family, Callum. Don't know what to tell you. I know that you guys don't because the Marxists broke up your family, which is expressly what Marx and Engels wanted to do. But
my
worry.
Family.
Yeah, my family's just fine. And I'm making stacks of cash. This Marxism grift is great.
Death to the nuclear family, except mine. And also death to
property
ownership.
Yeah, but not
except,
mine.
Except my four houses.
That's right.
God.
Equality isn't about people struggling together. It's about thriving and knowing that the only way we can do this is by working together. Social justice movements like the one championed by Cullors work towards the understanding that we're all important and should be valued, that black lives matter too. The absolute cope of this article is incredible. God. It's fine that she owns four houses off of all of these donations while black people struggle. That's equity.
I mean, you can tell the author understands that she's been sold a lie and this was all a way to, you know, it was a pyramid scheme.
I called myself out though.
Yeah. I mean, it literally is the Communist Party members killing themselves not to embarrass the party.
Yes.
It's embarrassing.
That's literally what she's doing in this article. Well, metaphorically. But in 2020, Colours appeared in a video where she confirmed that she believed in Marxism as a philosophy that questions capitalism. We can get to a place where there is a socioeconomic system that doesn't oppress some groups of people and only uplifts a few. That's really ironic, isn't it? Like, because the socioeconomic position has really uplifted Patrice into her fourth house, while most black people don't actually own their own homes. We'll get to that in a minute. That's the description of her personal ideology matters. She is not advocating for collectivized farms or a communist dystopia, nor has she ever. She simply believes in questioning the status quo, in challenging economic systems that currently lead to unequal outcomes, and in holding capitalism to account. That's right, guys. Yes. Marxism is just about questioning the status quo.
That's all what Marxism ever was.
Critical thinking. That's all it ever was.
The Bolshevik Party. They were just critics. They
just critics of capitalism. Just innocent critics.
Mao Zedong was just writing informal letters.
Oh, let 100 flowers bloom. She's holding capitalism to account, you see, by being a predatory landowning capitalist. And I love this last bit of this. There's no reason why a person can't have personal luxuries while running a profitable business and also advocating for racial justice. That's amazing. I agree. Like, I agree there's no reason, but I'm not a communist.
It just reads like Stalin's, you know,
self-justification.
Like, yeah, he has all the vodka and everything, but no one else needs it. No one else needs food. Just Stalin.
There's no reason why the dear leader can't have all the luxuries while I'm working in the farms. There's no reason why one shouldn't find some facets of Marxism fascinating and intellectually interesting, and others not at all, while at the same time living within a capitalist society. All of these subtleties and nuances are allowed in a person's life while they believe and fight for anti-racist causes at the same time. That's right. I can't think of a better way of showing that you're dedicated to anti-racist causes than making tens of millions of dollars and living in mansions. That's the best way of demonstrating your dedication to the poor, oppressed, struggling black proletariat. There's no other way of doing it. But so I thought we'd just ask Karl Marx on his opinion on this. So I just went to the Communist Manifesto, and he says the distinguishing feature of communism is not the abolition of property generally, but the abolition of bourgeois property. Ah, wait. I think a mansion might count as bourgeois property.
1.4 million in market value.
I mean, honestly, I think all of the homes count as bourgeois property, actually.
I mean, the minimum being like 400,000.
Yeah, half a million upwards. I'm pretty sure it is. Modern bourgeois private property is the final and most complete expression of the system of producing and appropriating products that is based on class antagonisms of the exploitation of the many by the few. Wow, it sounds like Jeremy Corbyn, doesn't he? but yeah, so ringing any bells, Patrice? Exploitation of the many by those very few people who live in their nice houses.
Like, you know how you're a trained Marxist? I assume you read some things.
Ding, ding, anything in there? So yeah, I mean, and obviously in this sense, the theory of the communists may be summed up in a single sentence. The abolition of private property. You don't need those homes, lady. Yeah. That's what he's saying.
Why can't you put them into the BLM trust or something and then hand it out to random black families?
That's a great question.
That you want to break up.
Why weren't they building, like, you know, big, you know, like tower blocks or something in which these people could be housed?
Yeah.
Like, give them maybe their own plot of land or something and build a nice home on them so they can have a little family farm or something. I don't know.
But no, I need somewhere for my bikes.
I don't live in a... And a compound, you know, with private security. I don't know.
But anyway, I'm going to park my cars.
Let's let Marx finish his point, because I think he's making a really interesting one here. You're horrified our intending to do away with private property. He's talking about you, Patrice. But in your existing society, private property is already done away with for 9/10 of the population. Its existence for the few is solely due to its non-existence in the hands of those 9/10. Ooh, this is starting to sound interesting, isn't it, Patrice? You reproach us, therefore, with intending to do away with a form of property, the necessary condition for whose existence is the non-existence of any property for the immense majority of society. In one word, you reproach us for intending to do away with your property. Precisely so. That is what we intend. Wow, I don't know, Patrice. He's making some good points. Maybe we do need to start getting rid of people's property. What do you think?
I'm not even sure we call it property. I mean, we're four compounds. It sort of sounds like a feudal, you know, lordship.
Kingdom, yeah. Okay. we're abolishing duchies as well, Patrice. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so just to go on to, like,
Patrice's, fiefdom.
Marx's point, though, is actually underscored by the fact that among black families, only 44% own their own home, Patrice being one of those. For the many, not the few. Oh, no, no, wait, the other way around. Sorry. But anyway, so as you can see, this is a massive, massive grift from Black Lives Matter. It is literally, I got mine, so screw you. It's for my family, even though you don't need a family.
Yep.
Don't know what else to tell you.
And also, here's my four homes. You don't need a home.
Nope.
Because Marxism is the way, comrades.
Yep. Seize the means of production. Anyway, the mother of Breonna Taylor, or sorry, the Breonna Taylor's family, have also come out and condemned Black Lives Matter, as the Daily Wire reports. Her mother said, I could walk into a room full of people who claim to be here for Breonna's family who don't even know who I am. I've watched you all raise money on behalf of Breonna's family who have never done a damn thing for us, nor have we needed it, so talk about fraud. It's amazing to see how many people have lost focus. I say this before I go, so I'm sick of you all, and the last anyone who needs it, I'm enough with this, enough is enough. So, I mean, I don't know how else we can demonstrate that Black Lives Matter is a grift if the families of the victims haven't got any of the money that has been raised, according to their own testimony, if the founders of Black Lives Matter, despite being communists, are now living the capitalist high life in multiple mansions. I mean, what more would you need? I guess a signed confession. This was a big grift, signed Patrice.
But I do have to disagree. I mean, I'm sorry to disagree, but disagree with her mother on one point, though. She said they've all lost focus. They never lost focus. They had a sole goal they were getting on, which is lots of money and also lots of power.
Yes.
And they've got there.
But they did lie to her, and they lied to her that they had a focus on helping black lives. So, I mean, if she believes that they were helping black lives, then from her perspective, they have lost focus. From their own perspective, they're doing a great job.
They've tremendously raised a few black lives. They've done their bit for the community.
Me, my husband, my sister, our kids, we're doing great.
We've got four homes to fill. That's not enough. Got to pull in the extended family.
Well, I imagine she's got them to hand. But that's the point, isn't it? It's like this is all a massive, massive grift. And these people knew what they were doing. They're not actually communists, which, I mean, I should be pleased about, really. Like, I don't really want to see communists succeeding, but I mean,
well, I do kind of love seeing them become the ultra-capitalists.
It does always amuse me to watch them join the bourgeoisie. Anyway, for the final segment I want to talk about was just this article, which I found really interesting. And so I'm going to deploy the forbidden argument with this.
Oh, God. There we go.
So yeah, crack my knuckles. We're on patrol. Egg patrol.
What?
Well, unmarried, child-free women like me should be celebrated, not criticized, says Katrine Hart, a 53-year-old woman.
Right.
So in the same way of Patrice saying, hey, it's okay that I've got a multi-million dollar house and a bunch of houses and I'm, you know, living there with my family because Black Lives Matter, this is kind of self-serving in that very same way.
I mean, she's not saying I should be accepted or just, you know, free to do as I wish. Celebrated.
Celebrated. We need society to gather around and tell her that she's done a great job.
But also not criticized.
Not criticized. Celebrated.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't agree.
Hmm. Well, let's hear her case. She says, it was never an ultimate goal of mine to get married and have kids. While girls at school were dreaming of fairy tale weddings and cute baby names, I was fantasizing about becoming an actress and traveling the world. So after graduating from uni, that's exactly what I did. I performed in front of the camera in small independent films in New York and on various stages across Germany. In 2008, when I decided to pursue a career in journalism, I moved to London. There is no room for in my life for a serious boyfriend, let alone children. Okay, it's her choice. Yet, as my ticking biological clock grew louder during my mid-30s, so did the pressure I felt from society to settle down and lead a more conventional life. Blockbuster movies, television shows, as well as magazine advertisements seemed to ascribe to the notion that tying the knot and changing nappies was the key to a woman's eternal joy. My sisters were married with children, as were all my female friends. In a bout of insecurity, I'd ask myself, shouldn't I be too? Men were looking at me weird when I'd mentioned that at the age of 40, I was single and child-free. One was going as far to inquire as what went wrong, another telling me that it was selfish for women not to procreate. Such rude, insensitive comments would leave me reeling.
They kept sending me egg carton memes.
I couldn't use my Twitter account at all. But that's interesting, isn't it? It was telling me it was selfish for women not to procreate. Now, I don't think that's necessarily just for women. If you're going to say it's selfish not to procreate, we'll elaborate this as we get to the end. She says, almost out of spite, I tried for 3 years with my then boyfriend Thomas to conceive, including 2 failed rounds of IVF. Now, I think, again, going back to the article that we covered the other day, where it's like, actually, women can have fertile years up until they're like 37, maybe, but why risk it? Yet another example where, I was 40 and I thought I'd have kids and it didn't happen. No, nature is cruel and these things aren't guaranteed. So when you've got more chance of it, maybe you should consider it then. But of course, she didn't really want children, so maybe it's a good thing that she didn't get them. She says, that relationship wasn't meant to be. In 2012, he ended things, and in hindsight, I see it as a blessing that I've never had to witness a positive blue line appear on a home pregnancy test. Today, I'm 53 with neither a wedding band on my finger nor any offspring which I can call my own, and I couldn't be happier. Which is, I'm sure, the reason you wrote this article. You were just blooming with happiness. I'm so happy. I need to tell people about this.
Yeah, that I should be celebrated and not criticized.
Yeah. I'm just so happy. Just so happy about it. I spent the last 10 years dating a slew of men, one 20 years my junior. Well done. And enjoying the freedom that goes along with never having given birth. On my first solo holiday in 2012, I flew to Fuerteventura. Thanks, John. And where I rang in the new year learning how to kite surf. With the Johnny Foreigner Land. Yeah. But, okay. And then one Christmas, I pampered myself at a detox retreat in Koh Suami. I've been to Morocco and Spain. I've been on girls' trips to Egypt and Dubai. How exciting for her. That's just great. I love hearing about her holidays. These are wonderful. Holidays. On her own. Roaming the globe as a bachelorette has been one of the most liberating feelings I've ever had. A whole new world opened itself up to me, both figuratively and literally. I've had adventures I'm not sure I would have had the chance to experience as a wife or mother. To mark my 50th, I explored Barcelona by bike with 3 girlfriends, presumably all childless. In 2018, I received a master's degree in cultural studies, and as a reward, splurged on a 2.5-week backpacking tour of Bali. Later that year, I drove up and down the coast of Portugal in a rented Fiat 500, giggling non-stop with one of my best friends. Roaming the globe as a bachelorette has been one of the most liberated feelings I've ever had. So liberating, she had to tell us twice. It's liberating. More liberation. Liberating. Lib. Liberation in all ways, for all time. Otherwise known as ostracization, incidentally. By the way, normally when you have this few bonds between other human beings, you're considered to be a lonely outcast. But she's not. She's having a good time. Observing couples who have spent decades together joined at the hip, I do wonder how happy they are. Many are trapped in unhealthy patterns, bickering, dismissing their spouse's feelings, no longer laughing. Wouldn't life be so much more fun without supposed better half? As I now watch my 4 female friends go through painful divorces, fighting with their ex-husbands over money and custody of their brood, I thank my lucky stars I've been spared all that. And perhaps that is the upside. She doesn't have to go through a divorce.
It's a pretty weird way of looking at life. Like, I'm glad I didn't have any of the pain because I had none of the joy.
I don't want to have to put my dog down at some point, so I'm not going to get a puppy.
Yeah.
Checkmate, nature. On the other hand, I couldn't be more proud of these ladies for taking such a courageous step, recreating their lives and embarking on a new path. Yes, because misery loves company. Since my most recent relationship came to an abrupt halt in July because of the lockdown, I've spent a lot of time focusing on my personal growth. The amount of clarity I've gained has been a real eye-opener, and I'm incredibly grateful for having had this time alone with no one around to distract me with their wants and needs. Sounds really lonely. Like, literally, I'm on my own. I've grown as a person. Boom, boom, boom. Okay, but who are you going to share that knowledge with? You don't share anything with us. Like, normally you'd, like, teach your children this, perhaps? Share it with your spouse? I don't know, but she just sat in an apartment alone, presumably drinking wine. It's been a while since I heard a man make a derogatory comment on either my marital or family status. Perhaps this is because in the Me Too era, they're too scared to say anything that might be misconstrued as harassment, or they're afraid that they might succumb to today's cancel culture for causing offence. Perhaps this woke generation is simply too woke. Which sounds terrifying, doesn't it? It makes it sound like she's sitting at the very top of a pyramid of tyranny. And she's like, you're all too scared to say anything about me now, aren't you? Or it could be that once you meet a woman in her mid-50s, you're like, yeah, there's no hope for her now. She's the eggs have gone. Like, the carton's empty. There's no point saying you should start a family, because she's like, dude, it's way past that. But maybe it's because they see a self-confident woman standing before them who radiates inner strength and independence, who has made no compromises in life, and as a result is fulfilled, because she knows that she is enough to fulfill and achieve her hopes and dreams. That's what they're thinking. That's what they're all thinking. Mm. They were watching you go by as a radiant goddess going, wow, she's really got all this down.
That's totally how you see yourself as well. Mm. I've achieved all my hopes and dreams. Let me tell you about how it's all fine and everything's fine. Yeah.
I'm so fine. I'm so fine I wrote this article telling you how fine I am. Other people think the things that are about to come out of my head through my keyboard about how I'm a self-confident woman, blah, 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 blah. Okay, sure. I'll just take it on your word. You are. You absolutely are. I dare anyone to make me feel bad about myself for that. Challenge accepted. I will do this. I will be that brave person to make you feel bad about this. Just as I'm sure there are many women who are blissfully married with children, there are a bunch of us who never married nor had children who are just as content. I'm sure. And that, you know what contentedness with your life is? It's writing articles about how content you are with your life. That's what you do. You spend all day going, I'm so content. It doesn't seem smug or anything.
It's also literally the meme of asking a woman, is everything all right? Fine.
Yep,
sure you are.
Yep. Like... So instead of stigmatizing those who resisted the pressure to conform society's norms, we ought to raise our glass in celebration and congratulate these women for their perseverance, determination, and tenacity to march to the beat of their own drum. Which is to say, not to say that I wouldn't welcome an amazing man by my side with whom to grow old, so long as he doesn't ask me to marry him.
Oh, she really let down the side with that last statement.
She really did. I was actually gutted, because up until that point, I was kind of starting to buy into it. It's like, maybe she is just so successful and so, you know, enjoying herself, and she just doesn't need anything.
There is something admirable in a person who's content with that. Well, if she genuinely was and was like, no, I'm just going to go on my own drum. Yep. I think that's cool, because, you know, we're chads who are going to become the CEOs of the world or something.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, but I would welcome a husband if anyone's free. It's like,
kind of undermines her case. But the point is, like, what does she tell us about her life? And really, it seems to be a life purely of hedonism. Right? She's lived her life for her. She doesn't appear to have lived her life for anyone else. Where's the virtue in this? Why is this good?
What will last?
Well, it doesn't even matter about that. Like, just where's the moral good in living a purely selfish life? I mean, anyone can do this. This is, in fact, the default of humanity, is to live your life for yourself. You know, and this is not something we lionize. We say, oh, people who do charity, people who go overseas and help the poor or tend to the sick. Not wine aunts who are like, yeah, well, I was driving around the coast of Portugal.
What does she preserve?
Exactly. What is she creating? She's doing nothing but just enjoying. I will just be a coomer until I die, she says. I've lived for myself, applaud me, is not exactly good messaging, in my opinion. And it's not good messaging for future generations, which I guess she didn't consider, really. And what I find interesting about this is that, well, it's kind of difficult to suggest that this is a lifestyle that everyone should accept. Because, I mean, like, A, if everyone decided to do that, how are you going to do all of the things that required other people's input? Like, if she goes paragliding or something, she needs people to operate the paragliding sort of company that takes her to wherever she goes, to build the equipment. And so she's relying on the labor of other people. And to rely on the labor of other people, you have to assume that there are other people there. Okay, well, how do we get other people there? Well, we have to contribute to the process that is civilization by having our own children, or else there is literally not going to be enough labor around for you to do this. And you could say, well, what about immigrants? Okay, so you're going to be a parasite on the labor of foreigners. As they raise their children, you're going to offer them money and they're going to come and be your servants, are they? It's like, where is this going? Like, how could this possibly be something that she could promote as a virtue, when what she seems to have done is found herself at the top of society and then done nothing but indulge her own desires?
You're right, but what I'm struck by is it's not even anything like keeping society going, you know, through childbirth and all mm-hmm. the rest of it. There's not even anything small. There's not like, oh, there's a mural in my town that I keep up, you know, clean and preserve it for future generations.
She does nothing for anyone else.
Nada. I mean, maybe she has something in her life, but she doesn't mention it at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, if she had mentioned something, then fine, you know, I'd be wrong. And maybe she's keeping all of the kind and charitable works she does secret because she doesn't want to brag.
Yeah.
You know, she just goes on holiday all the time.
She just want to brag about living a hedonistic life.
She seems that she does.
She's totally fine with, by the way.
So basically, if I wanted to make her feel bad about this, if I wanted to stigmatize her about her life choices...
As she's asked,
I would call her a leech. She is leeching off of other people's efforts in child rearing. And I can say as a father, it's not easy, but it is rewarding. But she expects that other people will raise the children that she needs to fulfill the other functions in society that she herself is not functioning. I mean, she's not exactly being cabin in the woods kind of frontiersman, is she? You know, yeah, I was building. I mean, and don't get me wrong, if she's like, you know what, I was like, no, screw you. Screw your society. Screw all of this. I'm going to go live in the woods, build myself a cabin, and hunt deer or something.
Then she'd be preserving something.
Yes, but also she'd be building something and she would be self-sufficient, and I could respect that. I'd be like, okay, fine. That's fine. But instead, you're like, no, I'm just going to use everyone else's unpaid labor of raising those kids. And, you know, just seems really selfish. But the question as well raises itself is she actually happy or is she merely consistently occupied? Like, she's like, oh, well, I'm going here, I'm doing this, I'm going, okay. But, like, the need to constantly do like things like this, to me, strikes me as someone who is deeply unsatisfied with their personal life at home. You know, you don't need to go off and do all of these things if you feel like you have a satisfactory life. You know, the sort of people who are constantly like, oh, I have to go on holiday. It's like, well, why aren't you happy where you are? Like, why aren't you happy with your life? What have you done? And then you've got the sort of like, well, who's going to remember you? Who's going to care when you die? You know, who's going to know anything about you? Who's going to think about you with fondness after you go?
But that's the thing. I was actually, the end part there. And I was in agreement with you that actually kind of, you know, it would sound kind of chad.
Yeah.
If she was just like, nope, this is just how I'm going to live my life. I think it's great. It's amazing. All right. Yeah, fine. If that's your choice. I mean, no one should rescind it or the rest of it. But the fact that that last line, like she completely undermines everything she's just said.
Yeah. Again, go and build a cabin in the woods if you want to reject society. Fine, you know, chad, in fact. Yeah. But sitting there leeching off of the products of society while you're like, yeah, but I don't have to contribute to this in any way, shape, or form. You're going to do it for me. Not my problem. And no, Callum doesn't want kids. Yeah, I don't care.
It's not true.
It doesn't even change my point. I'll shame you too.
I need a woman before I can have kids, Carl.
That's true. But this is the point, though. What lasting satisfaction has she gained? What has she done for anyone else? Why will anyone remember her? And all she is presenting is a monument to her own indulgence. Look how happy I am with constant coomerism. Good for you. So no, I don't think this is a life worth celebrating. And to be honest with you, I'm not even bothered about condemning it either, though. You know, I mean, like, if you wanna be like this, then go ahead. But these things don't last forever. And I'm guessing because you were 53 when you wrote this article, you're starting to realize that you're coming to the end of this sort of ability in your life. And then you've got, what, another 30 years at the very least? What are you going to do? Not going to be much skiing going on when you're in your 80s. Not going to get very many visits from other people, since literally who's going to know who you are? And what a sad end.
And on that bombshell, let's go to the video comments.
Yeah.
And so my addition to the show and tell is complete. As you can see, nice and fluffy almond bottom. There's nice and soft chocolate on top, but it doesn't flow away. So it's a big, big success in my opinion. I dedicate this cake to Project Veritas's continued success. May we hope that they do more good work out there.
That's not keto friendly. Let's go to the next one.
I can't even see a video cake without spurging out.
So, not shame. Exactly a question today, but I got a huge kick out of yesterday's redneck commenter. Hate to beat a dead horse, I promise this is the last time. But my entire family sort of traditionally redneck. Grandfather ran a sawmill, grandmother ran a farm. We're all descendant from Scotch farmers. We're all pretty working class, but I thought it was super funny because we're all super Presbyterian. My grandfather had to convert, so I thought that was pretty funny.
I really like the picture in the background as well. Looked really nice.
Chat's making a good point here, because I am wondering. So let's say you started your own bakery, mm-hmm. and of course, being the keto fascist that you are,
yep.
the only bakery goods you offer are all keto-friendly.
Sure.
And someone comes in, let's say it's me, I'm like, oh, hello, good sir. I'd like a gay wedding cake. And you're like, yeah, I'm liberal. I don't care about you being gay. Yeah. But I'd like sugar in it.
No.
Can you actually do that?
No, because I wouldn't have any sugar in the shop.
But that's the thing. The Equality Act says that my beliefs, not just my religious beliefs or sexual orientation, are also protected.
Yeah, exactly, John. Like, that would be like me going into...
Don't worry. I brought the sugar with me. As a caring customer,
we can't accept donations. I mean, I don't know what's out there. There's health and safety regulations.
Don't worry, it's sealed. I got it from.
I can't just take your sugar. That's disgusting as well. But this is like going into a motorbike shop and saying, "Hi, I'd like to buy a car." Well, why did you come here? You know, like we live in a sinful, degenerate, sugar-eating society as it is.
The only bigotry that's still allowed is keto fascism in this country.
How is it you ended up at the one shop in all of the world that doesn't sell sugar?
It's just you, keto state.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's go with the next question.
So, fairly recently, I've actually found a song on Spotify called Masculine Women and Feminine Men. It was initially produced and released in 1926, and it's surprising how little society has actually changed and just how worse society has gotten in reference to yesterday's stream, Carl. But, give it a listen. I think you'll find it interesting.
Hey, hey, women are going mad today. Hey, hey, fellas are just as bad, I'll say. Go anywhere, just stand and stare. You'll say they're bucks when you look at the clothes they wear. Masculine women, feminine men, which is a rooster, which is a hen? It's hard to tell them apart today and say, sister is busy learning to shave, brother just lost his permanent wave. It's hard to tell them apart today. Hey, hey, girls were girls and boys were boys when I was the top. Now we don't know who is who or even what's what. Knickers and trousers, baggy and wide, nobody knows who's walking inside. Those masculine women and feminine men.
We dedicate that video to the brave men and women of Tavistock at the NHS.
I thought you were going to... Was it Magnus Herschel's Institute for Sexual Studies? I thought you were going to dedicate it to then.
Don't even know what that is.
It's the transgender university that the Nazis burned down.
Oh, Jesus.
Because...
Would have been less funny, I think.
Well...
sister is learning to shave. Yeah.
Well, what I'm saying is there's nothing new under the sun, and we appear to have come right back around to a certain kind of Weimar-esque position, and that's not good.
Yeah. There is one thing in there I do find interesting, though, because you hear a lot of people who... I mean, me included as well, like, I'm guilty of this, saying that it's a shame that more women don't dress more feminine or act more feminine. Mm. And it's especially true when you go to Eastern Europe and you see the women there. It's very culturally different. And you look back at, like...
Honestly, same in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, so, but I mean, what is it, like, Academic Agent did a stream on this, where he's looking at, like, old England, and you see the women, how they're dressed, the men, how they're dressed. And he's right to point out that it's not just women as well. Like, you see the women wearing dresses back then, not today, but also the men. Like, men would wear suits everywhere. Like, you saw even in the poor quarters, people wearing, you know, smart-looking things. Probably stunk to high hell.
But watch footage of, like, you know, early 20th century London, and it's just loads of working-class men all wearing suits.
It's like a foreign land or something.
Yeah.
But
the thing is, my wife would be thrilled with it if we brought that back, because she loves it when, you know, like, men have to wear suits, and so I have to wear a suit. It's like, okay, great.
Exactly. But then the women would also have to wear dresses every day.
That's right. So checkmate.
To be honest, it actually does sound like a good Sharia rule.
It could be worse, couldn't it? Could be worse.
Anyway, go for the next question.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. On this whole Idris Elba thing, does my use of reggae sauce, is that a form of blackface now? If I smoke this cigar, am I a communist?
Yes, according to the BBC.
But that's only their diversity director.
Yeah. I mean, literally the political commissar of the entire organization. So.
Let's go for the next one.
Has anybody else had a sudden urge to move to Florida and buy an F-450 Super GE? In the immortal words of Homer Simpson, that name again is Mr. Plow.
ones I'm referencing.
I don't get the car reference either. But the move to Florida one, I mean, doesn't look too bad. Except from the summer.
Insufferably hot.
I keep complaining about this. Why did you go in the summer? Well, that's
my
your
wife
folly.
Made me. That's
yeah,
why.
But that's your folly.
Yeah, I know. I agree. You know, this is why I've rescinded my position on the 53-year-old singleton, the genetic dead end, who's like, no, actually, I did the right thing. I'm something. Well, you didn't have to go on holiday in Florida in the summer. So yeah, I mean, so, you know,
checkmate, Carl.
Yeah, yeah. Checkmate, dads.
Yeah, she went cycling in Portugal instead. It was lovely.
Base Bulgarian says, I finally caught up watching the episodes in the last few weeks. Boy, that Vox expert on the Floyd trial gave everyone the Groucho Marx treatment. Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Also, what is a more powerful opioid, St. Floyd's fentanyl or BLM's copium stash, that they're saving for the day that Chauvin walks out of court a free man?
If the knee doesn't fit, you must acquit. That was actually one of the fence's arguments.
Drew says, as far as I'm concerned, Maxine Waters has taken responsibility for any violence that comes to Minneapolis. That's only because she was inciting it. Lee Burdett says, makes you wonder what they mean when they say no justice, no peace. Seems more and more that they mean no justice and no peace. Either way, they have broken. They have a broken idea of what justice is, and they can no longer claim they are peaceful protesters.
Well, their form of justice is social justice, which is not justice. That's why it has the word social in front.
Yeah.
I mean, why does that have that little part for it? It's because they argue that because he's black and cop is white, therefore this is about black and white communities and not about George Floyd, Derek Chauvin. They don't care about the people. That's why they don't care about the case. Don't care about the details. It was all decided before.
There's a part of me that kind of wishes that Derek Chauvin had agreed to testify in his own defense and had just turned up with a Klan hood.
Nah. I don't think that would have worked.
I mean, I'm not saying it would have worked. It would just been really
I feel like
funny.
His wife and kids might have had something to say about that.
I'm not saying he's a member of the Klan or anything. Yeah. It would have just been really funny optics.
remind me never to go to court with you.
I've never seen the inside of a courtroom. I've been a good boy all my life. Yeah. Armin says, Maxine Waters is literally calling for abolition of due process and openly calls for violence. If Trump ever incited half the violence she's inciting here, we'd have another 15 impeachments by now. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, like Trump can't even say don't do anything violent without being scrubbed off the internet. And Maxine Waters, with impunity, has been like, get in their faces, be more aggressive.
Yeah. Where's her Twitter account? Still there.
Yeah.
Where's her Facebook account? Still there.
Yeah.
It's not like she's nobody. Like, she's a congresswoman in an area that's about to explode, saying that we should, you know, go out and commit violence if we don't get the verdict we want.
Yeah.
A verdict which she's asking
for.
No,
we need.
Well, one that also can't be achieved. First-degree homicide.
Yeah, one that he's not even being tried on. It's all baked in. There's a we're on a train track, man, and it's just going forward. And you can see at the end of the rails, there's just this giant burning dumpster fire that you're about to crash into. Yeah. And there's literally nothing you can do to get off the rails.
Maxine Waters like throwing coal at the engine.
Yeah. She's busy stoking it. And all I'm saying is, if I lived in Minneapolis, I'd leave.
Get off the train.
Yeah, that's the only way. Michael says, Trump calls for peaceful demonstration in which his supporters regard an election with a number of highly concerning irregularities and acts so reprehensible that Trump is impeached for a second time, no less. Maxine Waters, unless a police officer is found guilty of murder with intent, we have to stay out on the streets and give them no peace. Approved for all audiences. Stunning and brave. Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? It's just the mask is just so clearly off at this point. It's just us good, you bad, deal with it. It's like, okay. It's not justice, but all right.
So I remember before Trump, this was always a bit under the surface.
Yeah.
And now it is the surface.
Yeah. Now the mask is just gone. And this is like, look, we're doing this because we don't like it. Long Talks on the Niche says, yes, BLM, you've cracked the code. After a year of attacking people, burning cities and ruining lives and achieving nothing, the solution is clearly to do it even more. Act like entitled brats who need to break things to get what they want, not adults with a plan and a goal. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? How, like, the trial isn't even over and there's already been looting.
Like, people are already getting shot.
Yeah. Just saying. We know exactly what's going to happen here. And we disavow. Chet says, I've worked as a paramedic for the last 10 years and I've treated my fair share of overdoses, excited delirium, cardiac and respiratory patients. When the Floyd video came out last year, I said from day one that Chauvin didn't kill him, that they were lying. See, I was right, Callum. It was clear to me that it was drug and cardiac in nature. I told you, you've spent no time around druggies.
No, this is something we had just before off camera, before we started off camera.
Yeah.
Which is, your position is that you're convinced he died of the drugs. And,
yeah.
Well, I'm not convinced after watching all the case. I'm not convinced that it's solely that. But what I am convinced
and
of...
And carbon monoxide poisoning. Okay, fine.
Well, that's... What I am convinced of is that there is no way anyone reasonable looking at this case can come to the conclusion that beyond a reasonable doubt that Chauvin was the cause of death, and also beyond a reasonable doubt he was acting in a manner which no one ought to act and could foreseeably act in that way. That's my opinion on it. But
yeah, I mean, there's no evidence to my knowledge that Chauvin has ever indicated that he wanted George Floyd to die. Like, he didn't take any, like, unnecessarily aggressive action or anything like that.
That's not necessarily the case. The case is, number one, was he the primary cause of death? That's one thing you've got to prove. And then you've got to prove that he is acting in a manner, you know, his use of force there is completely unjustified.
Sure.
Beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't think you can get either of those points.
No, I don't think you can either.
But I'm not of the opinion, which is that he definitely died of drugs. Mm. I just don't know. I think it's a really complex case. And anyone, particularly on the BLM side, who were just like, nah, I've seen the video footage. I'm not going to listen to the witness statements. I'm not going to read any of the you know, toxicology report, anything else. I'm done. There's something wrong with you. Like, you are not looking for justice.
I mean, one of the other things that Chet points out here is it's also worth noting that fentanyl not only causes depression to the respiratory drive, but it also causes the diaphragm muscles to become stiff or paralyzed at high doses, which further complicates respiration and makes ventilating these patients difficult.
That's what I mean. It's not open and shut.
But that actually implies that it kind of is a bit open and shut.
Well, it's argument for why he could have died of drugs, but that's enough to make the defense's case.
Sure. Karen says, Lotuses have done a consistently great job, stellar actually, on the Derek Chauvin trial. Your reporting is well-researched and well-presented. Giving all the details, only Crowder is on the same level. Well, thank you very much. Hey. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Black Gris Matter, Land of the White People, says BLM means buy large mansions. That's true. And the larger the better, and increasing in size, in fact, as you become more successful with your capitalist grift. Many of those homes are in capital black neighborhoods. No, they're not. One or two of them, in fact, are in black neighborhoods, but the other ones are not. Clayton says, oh, I bought these houses for my family. Well, what makes your family more important than the rest of the proletariat, comrade? Great question. We'll ask a capitalist. Lee Burdett says, I hope Patrice enjoys the insane taxes on wealth that the left advocates for, which is going to take her hard-earned money from her and her family. Couldn't happen to a more selfless person.
I can't get over how literally everything becomes a JREG meme as well.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure you've seen it. The JREG video is like, oh, I'm a humble bread trooper. Oh, please help me destroy the capitalism. And it's like 3 weeks later, he's got a second mansion or whatever. I'm a libertarian.
Armand says, I'm still completely blunted by the pure mask off moments with these people. The ideology is infiltrated deep enough and scarred enough people or scared enough people into compliance to have people stay in line. The part where this Marxist speaks of helping her own family as black lives is ridiculous. Where is the money coming from, honey? Where is the $1.5 million coming from? If it was just $1.5 million, I'd be like, well, I mean, that's quite a lot, but she's been, you know, raising huge amounts of money. She undoubtedly gets paid, you know.
So BLM, the global organization, said that they paid her over those 4 years $120,000.
Yep.
And okay, I'm willing to believe that they directly paid her $120,000. But those homes are worth millions.
Yep.
So where the rest of that money come from? And what else has she done of note? Nothing. She is just the face of Black Lives Matter. So presumably it's from giving talks and charging extortionate speaking fees or doing research or any other such
nonsense. Most charitable interpretation, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Worst is
they're just lying.
Yeah, and she just took the money from the foundation. Aaron says, no, the question isn't why, that's the thing, like, why should she help her own family above the rest of the families of the proletariat? That's the question. If you're a Marxist, you can't justify it within Marxist framework. And that's why she had to just come out and be like, well, it's my family.
Well, they define themselves as the proletariat.
Sure, but like,
the masses aren't really the same.
Well, no, exactly. But what makes her family different to any other black people?
We're representing their interests.
Exactly.
We're a class representative.
Yeah, but why her family?
Because she's better at representing their interests.
No, but... Look, why
the mob might think that they know what they want, but we know what they really want, and therefore we deserve better treatment.
But why hers.
Yeah.
I'm not saying some black people don't deserve houses, you know, from this Black Lives Matter, but why is it hers? And it's because, obviously, this is a grift. Like,
No, but I was just saying, if you wanted to justify it as Marxists do.
Yeah, but what she's done is creating an aristocracy, is what I'm saying.
But everyone does this. Like,
sure.
Soviet Union did this.
Apart from, yeah, sure, but that's why they're all like, well, that wasn't real communism.
Yeah, and it's embarrassing.
Exactly, and that's why this isn't real communism either, according to, like, online Marxists. Armin says, I'm still completely blunted by the pure Marxists. Oh, no, I read them. No, the question isn't why shouldn't she have a multi-million pound house? The question of the reality of the situation is, why does she own multiple multi-million dollar houses? The answer is, of course, all socialist leaders have multi-million dollar houses, you racist. Well, I mean, Fidel Castro did, so $1 billion in wealth when he died.
Also where
up
she could,
the revolution, comrade.
Like she, the reason you probably buy that many houses, I mean, I imagine she has to fly to New York and Los Angeles because it's the only two places.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to be inconvenienced with a hotel.
But then, you know, she's got one in Georgia.
You've got a communist revolution to enact here, comrade.
One in Georgia for a holiday. But then the fourth, I'm sort of like, nah, this is just you hiding your money. Like, you've got so much money that you've got it in the bank, and you're like, if the bank goes bust, I'll only get a percentage of this back, so let's invest it in houses. Which means she must be sitting on, like, Scrooge McDuck levels of cash.
Quite probably, yeah.
So.
BLM founder makes perfect sense. This woman can't give an interview without saying or three times a sentence. Of course she needs the commie grift. She'd never make it past the initial interview for any competent or respectable job. Joshua says, four legs good, two legs bad. Always becomes four legs good, two legs better. They are communists. This is how it ends up. Did Orwell call it or what? Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, Orwell was right about communists. They're all liars and hypocrites.
All bad people.
All bad people, yeah. Bad people are attracted to revolutionary ideologies because they view it as a way of sort of sweeping away their own misdeeds of the past. Mm. Chris says, so for the people who have like 9 kids and they need state assistance, are they still contributing to society or has the burden outweighed the contribution? Well, that's an interesting question. And I suppose we could break out the calculators. Women like this are exactly why I'll never get married, says Alexander. I'm so proud of my girlfriends dumping their husbands, tearing their children's lives apart and taking half his stuff. The absolute celebration of divorce is completely disgusting. Divorce ruins men and children. I imagine it also ruins women as well, to be honest.
Yep.
You write these sort of cope articles because this wasn't good, you know, and like it is literally tearing apart families. And she's like, well, I'm so proud of my sisters getting their divorces. I mean, at least you'll have someone to go, you know, driving around Portugal with now.
It really does look like chaos from 40K, this yes. kind of stuff, where it's like, I celebrate divorce. Like that woman who was doing that show, it was like, celebrations for abortions. You remember that one with the mm-hmm. glitter flying around?
Yeah. Shout your abortion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God damn.
But I mean, this is unironically watching the chaos gods come out of things. Korn, which I'm not going to make any comment on, Nurgle, Slaanesh and Tzeentch, you know, this is the radical, the four horsemen of the radical left are actually the gods of chaos. So, just waiting for the Emperor of Mankind to come back. Christopher says, how do we normalize the concept of women being homemakers again? My wife and my best friend's wife told us they both felt pressure to keep working, even if it wasn't needed financially, and still hold guilt over being full-time mums. How do we make it okay to be mums again? This is a great question. My wife gets the same thing. When she's like, oh, what do you do? Oh, I'm a stay-at-home mum. And people are like condescending to her. It's like, why? Why would you rather have... you're not a corporate drone. How disappointing for your family that must be. How sad your husband must be that you cook dinner for when he gets home at night. Yeah, it's awful. It's tragic. She gets to look after her own children all day as well. They didn't just shoved into a nursery. It's terrible.
The thing on my mind, I don't know why the reason I'm laughing is I'm thinking of the It's Okay to Be White campaign, but just It's Okay to Be Mums.
Yeah, that's basically what we're going to have to do. And then they'll be like, well, this is racism.
No, but it's the same thing. Like if the radical left get a hold of those leaflets, they'll be like, this is disgusting.
Yeah.
Why? Explain why.
Yeah. Why is it bad to be a mum? But this is the thing, there is a huge amount of pressure for it. This is why I cover stories like this, because it's like, this is just like a simple thing, but like beneath the layers, it's like, well, why did you write this article? Why did you feel the need to write this article? To self-justify and then try and bring in your other divorced friends when they're like, you know, in their 50s and justify and validate everything that you've done and all of your life decisions.
Gene Steeler cult.
Just saying, how is Warhammer not a prophecy? But that's the point. Frederick says, I'm excited to see the unmarried women segment. And again, right, I just want to be clear. I actually don't really care if you're married or not. You know, it's not really my problem. But I don't like seeing the sort of advocacy for it, right? This sort of advocacy of I was selfish my entire life and I'm happy with my selfishness and you should do the same. I can't stand it.
It's that celebratory part. I mean, if she was just like, yeah. I'm, you know, single, childless, I'm living my life, and that's all right.
Good.
That wouldn't really be the same as I'm childless, blah, blah, blah. Yeah,
I should be celebrated.
I mean, it's weird.
By who? your kids? Grandkids? Like, who's supposed to be celebrating you being a selfish person?
I mean, it's actually one of the points... I endlessly quote Douglas Murray on the show, but it's a point he made in which he points out that, the gay acceptance movement or black acceptance movement as equal shouldn't be one that becomes, you know, being gay better or being blacks better. And it's the same thing here. It's just like, if it's just you want to be X and accepted, that's fine. But trying to say I should be celebrated in the same way you celebrate LGBT pride at a country where homosexuals are accepted, then that's strange. Like, why are you doing that?
Yeah. Nicholas says, hi folks, been a while since I've left a comment, hope you're doing well. I think we're doing well. I'm finding it hard to decide which side is right. On one side, it is dadism, and it is without a doubt a great mindset and purpose of life for each man. Being a father is something everyone must experience. Why? It's like I've written this comment. On the other side...
Wait, you have.
On the other side, however, I see the problem with overpopulation. There are too many of us. In your opinion, is there a compromise that both sides can use to be... that both sides can benefit? I actually think that the concept of overpopulation is a bit of a Malthusian myth. That thing's true.
Seems to have been. Like we look back, like when we did Brave New World review, there was an interview with Huxley.
Yep.
And he even made the point in there, he was worried about overpopulation in like the 50s. And it was like, really? Like this has been going back that far?
Oh, yeah. This is in the 19th century.
This seems like a nothing burger.
Yeah, but at the time, I mean, I guess based on the data that he had, it wasn't actually like ridiculous to say, well, look, if X amount of farmland produces X amount of food... And we know how much farmland we have. We know how much food we can produce. And therefore, if population keeps growing as it is, we're all going to end up starving. It's like, sure, except we developed better ways of producing food. And it turns out that actually there's loads of land on Earth that we could farm if we needed to.
Oil's going to run out in the 70s or 2000. Yeah. It's like, yeah, well, you could just make new ways of getting it. So
we can fit the entire population of the planet into Texas alone, says John. That's probably true. The planet's actually enormous and it has massive amounts of land that we just don't cultivate. So it's just not true that overpopulation is a problem.
I mean, plus we're living in the West. Like, we don't even replace ourselves.
Oh, yeah, then we've got that problem of women having literally, like, 1.6 kids or something. So, the population is going to be declining for us anyway. So, you know, I don't agree, you know, that's the thing. Alexander Schoberg says...
So dadism wins, then?
Dadism wins. Right. Unmarried children who contribute positively to society should be celebrated. Freedom of the Agent theory supports this. Well, I agree. An example being a nun who works at an orphanage, teach children whose parents were too incompetent to raise them or are dead, or a pediatrician who is so engaged in saving children's lives, she has no time to provide a fulfilling life of her own. Exactly. But what did that woman do? Did she do any of these things? Hell no! She went around drinking and like partying and was like, yeah, I'm leaving the high life. You should celebrate me for being a hedonist. It's like, no, I'll celebrate the nun who's working in the orphanage. Thank you very much. Just saying. Ultimately, women should have the autonomy to do as they please, but it is down to society to educate future generations in biological realism. Exactly. I totally agree. Like, I wouldn't turn around and say you're not allowed to do that, and I wouldn't want the government telling us that we couldn't do or do other things.
As if such a thing could even be possible. Like,
what, enforced heterosexuality?
No, but enforce her to having kids.
Well, yeah, no, that ship sailed.
Yeah.
But the eggs are gone, man. The carton is empty. But that's the point, right? I mean, you know, I don't want the government telling me to do anything or anyone to do anything, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to have an opinion on what a good life path looks like. And that's, I think, is a disappointing life path. Well, all she can say is, I went somewhere and drank. Good for you. If more children are made into better adults by an unmarried, childless, celibate woman than that of a neglectful mother, how does your argument hold up? My argument isn't about those people at all. My argument is about the solipsism and selfishness of this particular woman who wants us to praise her for having done nothing but be selfish. Nitrocellulose doormat, I dread to think what that means, Today is a world of zeros being praised and lauded for being famous or vocal on pointless social media or by insipid press who seem to be scared, witless to go out and talk to people in person to find out the truth. As a woman, I see too many celebrations of women being pointless public exercises by both mine and my colleagues' thoughts actually devalue the person who is supposed to have done well. I want success, positivity, and wonderful surprises to be celebrated. Sick of it. Yeah, I mean, it's funny to be like, you know, memeing as like, you know, being like, no, women must be in the kitchen and blah, blah, blah. It's funny to do that, right? Because it's an amusing meme because nobody actually thinks this.
Yeah, it's absurd.
Yeah, it's absurd, right? But if you're going to sit there and go, you know, like this was in Metro, this is a very well-read publication, and be like, you know what, everyone should celebrate me for being a childless, singleton old woman.
Isn't the Metro the free like propaganda they hand out?
Yeah,
as well?
I don't know who pays for it.
But that means that it's explicitly made to try and change your mind. Yeah. It's not there to make money.
Yeah. And she's, yeah, exactly. Even if, I mean, if it was a Black Lives Matter style grift, at least I could respect the grift. But like on this, I can't even respect that. It's like, you know, she's just trying to be like, look, just do what I did because I'm honestly not regretting it. I swear to God. It's like, look, just, these are just unhealthy messages, bad for society at large. And I feel that they are worthy of being attacked. John says, after I found you and Jordan Peterson in late 2017, it wasn't long until the two of you had me strongly appreciating the meaning parenthood could give to one's life. As someone in their mid-20s, I've been struggling to find my path a little bit, and it gave me some motivation and a pathway when I was struggling to find them. Very thankful. In lieu of the last segment then, since then, I've come across quite a few girls my age who have no interest in having children, and it's really sad to see. It's sad to see the institutions embracing movements like feminism that are intentionally atomizing and dehumanizing. Yeah, I think this is a great point, because like meaning appears to be located in our relationships. That's where you find meaning. That's why she couldn't, when she's going through all the things she's done, like, I'm not impressed by any of it. I went on holiday a lot. I've been on holiday a lot. Big deal. Like, why do I look at that with greater meaning? Why should I look at that as like part of the tapestry of human existence that's worth preservation? I don't know.
I think that's a little narrow. So I think more you can find, you get meaning out of definitely relationships, but it's the things you build. So the relationships can be one aspect of that. But if you can't, for example, and instead you build some great temple or an amazing book or
right.
something,
nothing
you can
like
find
that
meaning.
Is built in isolation, right?
So yes. But that's I think, an old narrow just say it's the relationships itself. Like, you could do something outside of relationships that is obviously meaningful.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, yeah, but what that is still a relationship to something outside of yourself.
Yeah.
Right. And so you still stand in a relational position to whatever it is. And it's that, these sort of invisible bonds of relations between, I mean, it could just be like, you know, you go to the top of a cliff and you meditate in the middle of the night so you can see the Milky Way above you, right? And so this could, for you, have deep spiritual meaning and give you peace of mind and actually be something, you know, and this would be worth writing about. You know, you would have experiences there that other human beings wouldn't have. You would have something.
But it's the writing and the carrying on of that knowledge that's surely the meaningful part of that.
Well, it's the transmission of that. Yeah. And other people might be able to find meaning in what you have done there. But again, like, you're speaking about a kind of relation. You know, if you find satisfaction in sharing this knowledge with other people, then again, you're talking about a relation. But this woman is just talking about consuming, like going on holiday. I was giggling the whole time. It's like, well, just take helium then.
That's why no one will remember your name.
Exactly. But this is the thing. It's like there is essentially all meaning seems to be found in relations. I can't think of anywhere else that it's found. And if anyone's got an idea, let me know. Ignacio.
Well, chat, Teslas.
Ignacio says, when I see my girlfriend speak about how she looks forward to having kids and growing old alongside me, she glows and radiates happiness. She's also a landowner. She is buying the house we are going to live in and soon going to graduate from a STEM degree. Women writing articles like this are coping that their only measure of success is material. About consumption as well. Like, that's the measure of success. I drank. That's literally what the homeless person's measure of success on the park bench is. I got drunk. This woman wants to be celebrated by strangers and wider society because she doesn't have a family or any local community to celebrate her. Another consequence from neoliberal progressivism, breaking down the local connections and relationships people have to create hyper-atomized individuals and requiring dependence on the state and impersonal societal blocks, the race, gender, communities, for political power and a sense of togetherness, literally combining the worst of both individualism and collectivism. Fair points. Smoldering Ember says, "Hello, Lord Caesars. I just want to thank you for keeping my sanity from descending into madness, especially you, Carl, but also to ask a question. Since we settled on Eldars being the logical point of the modern left, what would be the final evolution of the libertarian right, and why is it orcs?" Can't think of a comeback to that.
Based.
Yeah, just agree.
Well, the Imperium got to be the authoritarian right, surely.
All I'm saying, of course they are.
Who's the authoritarian left? The Tyranids?
The Tau.
Yeah.
Well, all I'm saying is the orcs struggle with depression. No, they do not.
No, they don't.
Of course. That's the point.
Don't think about it.
Exactly. And what's the problem that we have now? Depression. Andy says, "Hi, Lord Seaters. Fantastic work as ever. Thank you very much. Connecting the dots from some topics last week and kind of stealing Callum's existing work, why not produce a section on the website that covers the non-complete list of unintended consequences caused by COVID, taken from a human perspective, as this concept is not often spoken of. The numbers, excuse me, can be looked up anywhere. For example, I didn't know that anyone had died from COVID, but I do know a school friend who died at 42 from inoperable cancer after his surgery was cancelled. A friend of mine tried to commit suicide and thankfully failed. Another friend has not worked in a year and lost his house as he was a chef. My father-in-law is on his deathbed due to a lack of care, and I'm having major surgery for a condition that was not treated for 6 months due to all resources being assigned. While anecdotal, this is far more meaningful and thick TM than the R rate or some stats scrolling past on the screen." Yeah, that's a great point. That's a good suggestion as well. Right, I think we're pretty much at the end there. Sorry, TF Allspark, you left a really long comment, and it'll take us ages to get through it.
All right, well, we'll be back tomorrow, 1 o'clock. See you then.